From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Reverend Joe Ingles' ministry is the penitentiary, his flock, the men and women on death row. On today's Fresh Air, Ingles tells us about his work with death row inmates throughout the South, comforting them, fighting for stays of execution, and sometimes watching them die. In the film Brother from Another Planet, Joe Morton played an extraterrestrial who couldn't speak. Now he plays a verbally facile prosecutor in the TV series Equal Justice. Coming up, Joe Morton on acting and race. And film critic Owen Gleiberman has a movie you might have missed the first time around, Let It Ride. It just came out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In the worst outbreak of violence in Romania since the overthrow of President Ceausescu last December, hundreds of demonstrators have forced their way into police headquarters in Bucharest and set fire to parts of the building. Others are said to have stormed a Ministry of Interior building, throwing gasoline bombs and using a truck to ram the main gate. The BBC's Owen Bennett-Jones reports from Bucharest.
Security forces have been firing weapons from the building of the Ministry of the Interior. Demonstrators are throwing Molotov cocktails into the building, but so far the security forces inside have managed to douse the flames. Meanwhile, President Iliescu has appeared on television saying that the demonstrators want to establish a fascist government. Earlier, he addressed a crowd of thousands of supporters in Victory Square, where the government headquarters are located. He told them that pro-government supporters were coming from the provinces to support the forces of order. The government supporters are beating up anyone they suspect of favoring the demonstrators. At one point, some protesters managed to get inside the television station where broadcasts were interrupted. But the army, using paratroopers, retook the station, and the government now has control of it.
Owen Bennett-Jones reporting from Bucharest. The Colombian armed forces are sending nearly 600 military and police troops to the city of Medellin. The authorities hope that they can rein in a rash of murders in the city, which is home to some of the country's most prominent drug kingpins. Leslie Werpser reports from Bogota.
A string of murders of policemen and massacres of slum dwellers has prompted Colombian authorities to militarize the city of Medellin. The authorities announced yesterday that an additional 350 soldiers and 220 members of a special police strike force will be sent to Medellin on Friday. 6 months ago, drug kingpin Pablo Escobar announced that he would pay the equivalent of $4,400 for each policeman killed in Colombia. Since then, 127 members of the police force have been killed in the Medellin streets. In recent weeks, heavily armed men wearing black hoods began mass killings of young people in the Medellin slums, where hired killers reportedly live in trains. Political analysts believe that the killings in the slums may be an act of revenge for the deaths among the police force. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Werpsa in Bogota.
An Illinois family's hopes to ransom its son from communist guerrillas appear to have been disappointed. Although Scott Heimdall's family and community raised $60,000, negotiators say that his kidnappers are demanding 10 times that amount. Heimdall, who's 27, was kidnapped in late April from an Ecuadorian mining company where he was employed. A spokesman for the mining company says that the rebels contend $60,000 that they've received already is only a down payment to guarantee his life. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 4 points to close at 2,929.7. This is NPR News. A West German businessman admitted today that his company helped to build a chemical weapons plant in Libya. Jürgen Himmelstiel Imhausen is on trial in West Germany for violating export laws and tax evasion in connection with a $136 million project. Himmelstiel said that he had suspicions that the plant would be in violation of West Germany's export laws, but didn't investigate because he didn't want to lose the business. West German officials say they have proof that the plant in the Libyan desert was made to produce poison gas. Libya denies it. Jury selection began today in the case of a woman who was assaulted last year as she jogged in New York Central Park. Three youths are on trial for attempted murder, rape, and sodomy. Yesterday, the judge presiding over the case barred cameras from the courtroom, keeping with his vow to prevent the trial from being dominated by the media. Carol Zimmer has this report.
Justice Thomas Galligan told potential jurors today that the case would be decided in the courtroom and not in the media. He also dismissed 140 potential jurors who said that they would not be able to serve for the duration of the trial, which is expected to last from 4 to 6 weeks. Prosecutors say they intend to call about 50 witnesses, one of whom may be the victim herself. Although the jogger, whose name has not been released because she is a rape victim, made a miraculous recovery and has been promoted in her job as an investment banker, she supposedly has no memory of the attack. Altogether, 6 youths have been charged with taking part in the assault. 3 of them, Antron McRae, Yusef Salam, and Raymond Santana, are defendants in the first trial. The other 3 will be tried later. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Zimmer reporting.
A statement from Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry is being broadcast at this hour on public television from Howard University. Barry is expected to announce he won't seek a fourth term as mayor. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joe Engel ministers to a congregation of the condemned, the inmates on death row. Engel is a minister in the United Church of Christ and director of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. He was twice nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for his work opposing the death penalty. His new book, Last Rites, is about his work with 12 men and one woman who he came to know well before they were executed. Engel first wondered what life was like in prison back in 1971 when he watched the TV reports on the Attica uprising. After that, he decided to work with prisoners in the Bronx House of Detention for his 9-month seminary project. It convinced him he should be working in prison ministry. He says when the death penalty was reinstated in 1976, he thought about what it meant to be a Christian in a country determined to legally kill people. He's worked with death row prisoners ever since, primarily in prisons throughout the South. I asked Engel how much access to death row inmates prison authorities allow him. Since he's not a prison chaplain, he works independently.
I have quite a bit of access, but it's not always due to the fact that I'm a minister. One of the ironies of the death penalty is that those of us who are in the clergy and who believe that our God would have us working against the death penalty are sometimes obstructed by the state chaplains who actually work in the prisons themselves and are paid by the state. The reason for that is these gentlemen are paid by the state and they have to answer to the warden, so the death row prisoners, for instance, don't usually confide in them. And they see some of us from the outside as threats. Now, that's an overgeneralization. In some instances, we've had a lot of cooperation. But very often when I visit a death row in a southern state, and I visit them all, I go through the warden's office, not the chaplain's office, because I have a whole lot better success dealing with wardens than I do chaplains.
Are there any restrictions that are placed on you? Are there any, for instance, right before the execution, can you be there as a minister of choice, or does it have to be the prison chaplain who spends those last minutes with the prisoner?
Well, as you can appreciate, since we started this work in 1977 with the first execution in Utah and then John Spinklink in 1979, the prison officials, like us, none of us knew what we were doing. We've had to evolve rules as we go, so we've had a lot of disagreements and arguments, but pretty much now, I can, as a minister, get in, and indeed, I was with Willie Darden when the state of Florida prepared him for killing on March 15, 1988, and then strapped him in the electric chair. And this morning, I received a letter from a dear friend of mine on death row in Florida who wants me to be with him when he fears he's going to be executed probably this fall. So I can be there with them as a minister. It's their choice.
But you don't usually go to the executions.
Well, I've had a rule up to Willie that I would not witness any of my friends being killed. I thought that was just too much. If you're going to work with people on death row and you learn to care for them and they for you and you love them and they love you, and to watch them strapped into a killing device and slaughtered is just a little much. But that night I was there at the Florida State Prison and Willie asked me to be there for him. When he was killed, and I couldn't say no. I'd known Willie for over 10 years. We were very close. He was innocent. We'd done everything we could, so I was there that morning for Willie, and we always try to have someone in the death chamber who loves the person who's being killed so that when they're killed, they're looking at someone who loves and cares for them and has worked for them, just not just official functionaries.
What kind of visual communication did you and Willie Darden have with each other in those last moments of his life?
Oh, gee, Terry, this is quite painful, so you have to give me a minute here. Willie and I talked about this. I was outside of his cell from about 1 a.m. till 5:30, and we had discussed what he wanted me to do. So when they loaded us all in the prison van and took us down to Q-Wing, where the death chamber is, and we walked into the room, I stood in the back so Willie could see me. And I wear a symbol around my neck, which is a gold symbol with a cross and over a circle and the equal marks in the circle. It's all are equal in the world under the cross. It's a symbol of the Committee of Southern Churchmen. And it's something Willie and I believed in. And so Willie wanted me to be there when they let him into the death chair holding the symbol so he could see me. So at 7 o'clock, the rear door to the death chamber opened and they escorted Willie in. He was, of course, manacled. His hands were handcuffed and manacled to his waist. His ankles were also hobbled, and they led him over to the chair and sat him down and removed the chains and then strapped him in and put a microphone in front of his face and asked him if he wanted to make a last statement. And he did, and he gave a very eloquent testimony to the fact that the state of Florida was executing an innocent man, that he had maintained his innocence from the beginning, and it had been over 14 years, and he was still innocent. And then he went on to thank those who had worked for his behalf and done everything they could for him, and mentioned some of us by name, and then said he bore no ill will toward anyone and wished that God bless us all. And at that point, he had already made eye contact with me before the statement, and when he was finished the statement, one of the guards put a hand to his chin and shoved his chin back against the headrest on the chair, and it winced. He winced. It hurt him. And he immediately looked at me and winked to let me know he was okay. And then they strapped the leather strap around his chin and put the death mask on his face and attached the cap to his head, and they'd already put the electrode on his left leg. And once they dropped that shroud over the face, they're ready to kill him. So Willie, even though his arms were strapped down, lifted his left wrist and waved with his hand and waved goodbye to me, and then they killed him.
Did you avert your eyes at the time of death?
Well, you know, once they dropped that shroud over Willie's face and he could not see me, I dropped my head in prayer because I had to get through this, and I prayed for Willie, and I prayed for myself, and I prayed for everyone who'd worked so hard to keep him alive, and I prayed for his wife, Felicia. I just prayed nonstop. As the book of Ephesians said, I prayed without ceasing. It's the only thing I knew to do to get through that moment.
Joseph Engel is my guest, and he ministers to people on death row, and his new book is called Last Rites. You don't believe in the death penalty. I wonder how you prepare people for a death that you don't believe in.
Well, we all die. I'm not preparing people to die. We're talking about killing people here. That's why I don't even like the term death penalty, and why I'm suggesting we use another term, what I call an administrative massacre, really, or an administrative slaughter. I don't go in there to prepare anybody for anything. These folks are friends of mine. I don't want people to think I'm riding in on a white horse and here I am preparing people at the last minute as they're killed. Nothing could be further from the truth. Folks on death row, without exception, do more ministering to me than I ever do to them. And anyone who goes into a death row will tell you that. It's an extraordinary experience. We have human beings in cages under conditions you could not possibly imagine. We feed them in their cells. We treat them worse than animals. And yet somehow they're able to triumph. The human spirit triumphs through all this, and friendships grow, and people change. And then you place them in a situation of incredible pressure where they're about to be killed. And under this torturous ordeal, somehow the grace of the Holy Spirit or whatever it is comes to the fore, and we see again and again these folks coming out of themselves and reaching out to people around them and ministering to people who love them and caring for them and being more concerned about the damage that their killing is going to have on their family and on those who've worked for them than what it's going to do to them. It's absolutely extraordinary, and perhaps some psychologist some they or some wise person can explain all this to me. All I do is I'm just there, and I'm a friend, and I try to help out.
Do you often ask the people on death row who you're close to who are about to be executed if there's anything that you can do for them after their death?
Oh, sure. Simple things like writing letters to people. You know, they don't always have time to write letters to everybody they want to write them to. Make sure family members getting certain mementos of their possessions, what few they have. And, you know, make sure that the state doesn't bury them. I mean, it seems like a simple thing, but the state wants to bury them on the prison grounds, so we don't want that to happen, so we usually end up having to help the family raise money to bury them in a place with dignity. So it's those kind of things that you have to deal with.
When you make the rounds on death row, do the men and women you talk to, do you feel that they have to accept Christ, or can they just accept your friendship?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I don't worry about people accepting Christ. I mean, my whole theology is that Jesus has accepted us, and that's the basic point. I'm not out here to win souls for anybody. I think Jesus takes care of all that. I'm there simply, the theologian Kierkegaard talked about the method of indirection, and he thought that was the best way to communicate the gospel, and I think he's absolutely right. I walk in there and visit people. I don't talk about religion. I'm not there to talk about religion. I'm talking about there to keep them alive and to help them in any way I can. And then if some way on down the line they get interested in why on earth I'm coming in here to help them, they might ask me. And if they ask me, then I tell them, well, I believe as a Christian that this is absolutely immoral and we shouldn't be doing this, and I'm going to do everything I can to keep it from happening to you. So that's the way I get into the whole religion thing, if they want to do it. But it's only if they bring it up that I even talk about it.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is Joseph Engel, and he's written a new book called Last Rites about his work on death row and about the people who he knows on death row who have been executed. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Joe Engel. He's a minister in the United Church of Christ, and he ministers to death row inmates. He's also the director of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. His new book is called Last Rites. You get very close with a lot of the inmates on death row who you work with. Now, I mean, most, you know, they're convicted of murder and you know, of terrible crimes. Are you ever frightened about what kind of people they really are?
Oh, no. I mean, I think that's part of the whole myth of who's on death row. They're some kind of monsters. Nothing could be further from the truth. They're ordinary folks like you and I, except for two things. Granted, they are convicted of committing a murder, but what sends them to death row is not necessarily committing the murder. We have 20,000 murders in this country a year. Of those 20,000, about 250 go to death row. Now, those 250 are characterized by two factors. One, they're all poor. 9 out of 10 folks who are on death row in this country could not afford a lawyer. And believe me, you buy justice in this country. And if you can't afford a lawyer and you're facing a first-degree murder charge, then that's a ticket to death row. And the second factor is almost everyone's killed a white person. Now, that's the way we function with the death penalty in this country. And historically, that's the way we function since 1608. It's discrimination on race of victim. We very rarely send someone to death row for killing a black person. So those are the two things, and that doesn't have anything to do with the person's personality or somebody being difficult to deal with. Quite the contrary. Most wardens will be the first ones to tell you that people who commit murder are the easiest people to deal with in their prison population. And that's because people who commit murder are not proud of what they've done. They're not proud at all. That's why it's the least repeated crime in the United States. In reality, most murderers are simply not likely to ever do the crime again, whether we put them in prison or not, much less kill them.
You must have, in addition to the people who you speak really highly of, you must have met some pretty unsavory characters on death row. Do you feel like you work equally hard for a stay of execution for someone who you really feel warmly towards as you do for someone who you don't much like, but you would still defend their right to live and not be executed?
Well, you need to understand something, and that is this. Augustine put it best. You hate the sin. You hate the act of what someone does, in this case, murder. God knows I hate murder, whether it's on the street corner or whether it's in a death chamber. I'm opposed to it. But Augustine also said this. He said, you love the sinner. And this is something we've lost in our society. You know, people can do awful things and still be human beings and still be worthy of love. You know, they still have mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and children who love them no matter what they've done. I mean, if it's your daughter or your son, do you want that person in an electric chair? Of course not. So I haven't met anyone on death row, and I've met people who've done awful things, terrible things, who I'm afraid of or who I think is what you would call an unsavory character. I haven't met a single unsavory character. I have met people who've done horrible deeds, but that does not define who they are. They are human beings like you and I, Terry. They're just not people who've done unsavory things.
Did you ever feel that you were being used or manipulated by someone, that you were being played for a sucker?
No, really. I mean, the only time, you know, in the early days, I had to work so hard to get in to see these people. The prison authorities didn't want me and my colleagues in the prisons to start with. But once we got in, it was very clear that, you know, we were about the only thread these folks had, one of the few threads they had. So the last thing we have to worry about being is manipulated. They want to work with us and do whatever they can to help, not only themselves, but each other and their families, because they realize what's going on. You know, we've got people pinned up like cattle. We're leading them down the chute, and one by one, we're slaughtering them. And they certainly want all the help they can get in that process. They're not interested in manipulating. And besides, how can they manipulate it? Lord, they're in such bad shape themselves in terms of conditions that they really can't manipulate anybody.
Do you ever run into suspicion of do-gooders?
No. You know, the people who think that you're a do-gooder usually think that for a little while, but when you keep doing something for 15 years, they realize there must be something more to it than that.
Well, do they know that you've been at it for 15 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, everybody on death row knows who I am. We've got a newsletter that goes out to everybody on death row. You know, we work very closely with people on death row. We want them to submit articles to the newsletter, so they know who we are and what we stand for.
Joe Engel is my guest, and he ministers to people on death row. He's written a new book about that called Last Rites. You've fought often to get stays of execution from governors, from the president. Were you ever successful?
Yes. I had a meeting with Governor Edwards along with Congressman John Conyers and a couple other folks for Willie Watson, a man who's on death row in Louisiana, and went to the governor's mansion at midnight, and the execution was, we were actually there at 9 o'clock. The governor kept us waiting for 2.5 hours. The execution was set for a little after midnight, so we're having this very intense conversation with the governor. The clock's ticking away in the governor's mansion, and they're going to kill Willie a little after midnight. And finally, the governor stood up and walked away and said he had to make a telephone call. Now, we're sitting here. We don't know what's going on. He's going to make a telephone call, and he comes back and tells us he stopped the execution. That's why he considers what we've had to say to him. And being the gracious owner he is, he invites us to stay in the mansion for the night, but I knew where that was going, so I said, no thanks. We went back to the hotel, and sure enough, 4 hours later, he lifted the stay, and they stripped Willie Watson into the electric chair and killed him. There are other people like Joseph Green Brown, who's totally innocent, who got off after 14 years on death row in Florida. So, you know, there are also innocent people in this book. Tim Baldwin, Willie Darden, James Adams are all electrocuted. The folks in the book are people I've worked with who've been killed by the state. I have worked with some others who have had better fates than that.
There's an expression that there's no guilty men in prison. I mean, so many prisoners will tell you that they're innocent even when they are guilty. Do you usually accept people on their word when they tell you that they're innocent?
Well, sure, you accept them on their word, but you're no fool. You know, you look at the legal brief, you look at the legal record, you see what's going on, because if you're going to really help the person, you have to know the facts. So you educate yourself about the person's legal case and whether or not they're telling you the truth. They're not telling you the truth. You let them know in short order that you know what the case is.
What would you recommend for people who've committed murder who are now on death row? What do you think the alternative should be?
Well, we ran a poll about this, Terry, because, you know, you keep reading about 80% of the American people are for the death penalty. And we chose the state of Georgia because the state of Georgia has executed more people in this century than any other state in the United States. And so we ran a poll, and we asked several questions, one of which was, well, are you for the death penalty for the mentally retarded? Well, 66% of Georgians said absolutely not. Well, they had actually executed Jerome Bowden down there, who was mentally retarded. So with our poll and with that execution, we were able to get the Georgia General Assembly to pass legislation to prevent execution of the mentally retarded. Second aspect of the poll was, how about juveniles? You want to execute juveniles, children, when they commit murder, people under 18? Well, absolutely not, 65% of the Georgians told us. Five people on death row are still, or juveniles on death row in Georgia right now. And then the third one, the big one, okay, what if we offered you a mandatory sentence of 25 years with restitution to the victim's family? And 52% of the citizens polled said they would be for that. And what that tells me, Terry, is that the opposition to the death penalty in this country is really quite significant. The support for it is a mile wide and an inch deep. Because when people come to understand that we're killing the retarded, that we're killing children, and we're not being any safer because, you know, there's no way the death penalty is a deterrent, that what we need is a mandatory sentence to satisfy people's legitimate needs for security. No one wants to be threatened or have members of their family hurt. So you have to have mandatory sentences for people to do significant lengths of time for murder. But they should also make restitutions to the victim's family. And I think that's what most Americans actually would like to see in regards to the death penalty. Now, we've got a problem because all our politicians want to lead us in the opposite direction, but I think eventually we'll get their attention.
Is there anything that you do really differently now when you enter prison than you did when you were younger and getting started?
Yeah, I have a very difficult time entering a prison if it's the same prison I was in recently when one of my friends was executed, one of my friends was slaughtered by the state. I have a very difficult time going back to that prison. As a matter of fact, a letter I got today was from a man whom I've known for years on Florida's death row who wants me to be with him this fall when he's going to be killed. And I just wept when I read it because I don't know if I can do it. I don't know if I can go back to that place. I've lost too many friends who've been strapped in that Florida electric chair. So I just don't know if I'll be able to go back and be with him. And I'll write him and tell him that, and I'll go and visit him here in a little while, and we'll talk about it, and we'll just see. So, you know, there's a real cost to all this, and I think it's called the cost of discipleship. I think that's what Dietrich Bonhoeffer called it.
Well, Joseph Engel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
And my guest has been Joseph Engel, and he ministers to inmates on death row. He's written a new book about that called Last Rites. He's also the director of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a talk with jazz tenor saxophonist Stan Getz. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Actor Joe Morton stayed away from TV for years because he didn't want to get stuck with stereotypical black roles. Coming up, Morton tells us how he landed a role written for a white Italian on the ABC series Equal Justice. And Owen Gleiberman reviews a new home video, Let It Ride, last summer's comedy starring Richard Dreyfuss as a gambler who's having the winning streak of his life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Saying that this is a time for healing, Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry said a short time ago that he will not run for re-election. In a taped appearance on Howard University Public Television, Barry said that his decision not to run again is a personal one, not related to his trial on drug and perjury charges. Barry said he will not resign his post because that would be disruptive, and that a primary is only 90 days away, and a new administration will take office the first of the year. In Moscow, the Soviet Parliament today approved historic economic changes to move the country toward a market economy. But a plan to raise bread prices ran into a storm of opposition. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The law passed today sketches the outlines for a market economy. It will replace the state's traditional system of dictating nearly all basic economic decisions, from what a factory produces to how much it can charge for its output. The plan gives almost no details, though, leaving it instead to the government and to President Mikhail Gorbachev to work out laws on banking reform, encouraging small business, and selling off state property. The parliament also debated proposed bread price increases, a plan that set off panic buying when it was first announced last month. After emotional calls to keep bread prices frozen at low levels, the parliament postponed further debate until tomorrow. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
And there have been massive anti-communist protests in Belgrade, the capital of Yugoslavia's largest republic, Serbia. Pierre Vickery reports that the demonstrations, organized by five illegal opposition parties, brought the city center to a standstill.
The demonstration in Republic Square was the largest anti-communist protest in Belgrade history, with over 30,000 people demanding multi-party elections before the end of the year. They carried Serbian flags with a communist star cut out and burnt pictures of the Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic. There were shouts of communist thieves and traitors, and we want democratic elections now. Hundreds of local people watched the procession from windows and rooftops. The size of the protest, despite television appeals for a boycott, is seen as a sign of growing anti-communist sentiment in what was previously Yugoslavia's most hard-line republic. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
In Nicaragua, the international airport at the capital is closed by an air traffic controller strike. The controllers want the government to reinstate an officer in the Sandinista-controlled army as chief of civil aeronautics. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 4 points to close at 2,929.70. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. It's hard to figure out who Joe Morton the person is by watching his movie roles, because they give such contradictory clues. In The Brother from Another Planet, he played a sensitive extraterrestrial who couldn't speak. But in Tap and Trouble in Mind, he played tough-talking, eccentric gangsters. Now he's an aggressive prosecuting attorney in the ABC series Equal Justice. It's a courtroom drama about a big city prosecutor's office. Here's Morton in the courtroom making his summary to the jury.
This is the worst case I've ever tried. I'm sick of it. You see these two gentlemen here? That's my boss. And that is the district attorney. The guy that you vote for. He doesn't want me to say this, but I've got to tell you something. This case is out of control. It's been tried in the streets, it's been tried in the corridors, it's been tried in the evening news, on the steps of this courthouse, but my God, there is only one place this case should be tried, and that is in this courtroom in front of you. Now, how could this happen? How?
Now, I know that the part that you got, the leading part on Equal Justice, wasn't the part that you were supposed to audition for. What part did you come in to read for?
They actually had me come in to read for a reverend who was supposed to be like an Al Sharpton-type character. The situation, I don't know if you remember the pilot, was like a Bensonhurst or like a Howard Beach kind of situation. And they had a character, as I say, who was sort of an Al Sharpton. And that's the part that they wanted me to audition for. I actually did end up reading for the part, and in fact, they offered it to me. That is, they called my agent, and they made a money deal and so forth. But in the meantime, I had asked them to let me read a character named Mike Corelli, who was the chief prosecutor. And they did let me read it, but they also made it quite clear that it would probably not be very possible for me to play the role, since they didn't think they could, quote-unquote, go black with a role like that. So after the offer was made, I thought, so that was sort of said and done. And then the weekend after they offered me the Al Sharpton role, they actually asked me to come to L.A. to audition for, that is to test in front of the network, for Mike Corelli. Carter Smith and I both ended up auditioning for the same role. Carter plays my boss in the show. He plays the bureau chief, and Rogan. And we both auditioned for Corelli. He read, then I read, then he read Rogan, then we went in. They had us read together. And that actually sort of cinched it. They liked the two of us together. They really enjoyed the sort of dynamic that takes place between the two of us. And they knew they were going to hire us both, but they weren't sure in which role, whether it would be either Rogan or Corelli. And as it turned out, he got Rogan and I got Corelli, and we're both very happy.
Is it best to be, like, really nice about these things when you want to audition for a role, or is it best to be really aggressive about it?
It's sort of, you know, when you're in business of any sort, you have to sort of find some gray area in between. You have to obviously maintain a certain amount of respect and politeness for the people that you're working with, but at the same time, you have to make it clear and evident to them that you are sincere and earnest about what you're asking, and that it's something that you think you can do a good job in.
Now, the executive producer and director of the program, well, the executive producer of the program who directed the pilot,
Thomas Carter,
yeah, is black himself, and
that's,
I was wondering,
right,
if he was helpful to you when you wanted to read for the prosecuting.
Well,
part.
I don't really know, as I say, what went on behind the scenes after I asked him. I mean, I think he was intrigued by the question. Thomas is a very interesting young man. I mean, he is both artistically inclined as well as commercially savvy. So I think he was put into a position where he had to sort of tread a very fine line. I mean, he certainly could not make it seem as if he wanted to push this idea simply because I was black. And yet at the same time, he was obviously most interested in finding the best actor for that role, which is why I think probably Carter and I ended up auditioning for the same role. He had to think about a couple of things. He had to think about what the pilot was going to do by itself before it had been picked up as a series, and whether it would work for the pilot. And then once he made that decision, he had to think, how is this character going to work all the way down the line in terms of the series? So there was a number of things that he had to think about and consider.
When you got the part of the prosecutor, the name of the role was changed from Mike Corelli to Michael James.
That's right.
Any other changes made in the character?
No, everything else remained the same. And that was the other thing that we all, without speaking about it, agreed on. In other words, once the character went black, we didn't suddenly want him to be, you know, a jazz aficionado and start
instead of opera, right, yeah.
Exactly, which is all fine within mm-hmm. itself, except that what I was trying to do, partly what I was trying to do, was create yet again another alternative for the kind of black people that you might see on the screen. We're used to seeing black men in particular as bad guys or as Al Sharptons or as people in the business world who are fixated on making lots of money and wearing good clothes. And I was looking for an alternative, and this was certainly an alternative, a guy who was involved with the prosecution end of things, who was involved with opera, and who was involved with being an Italian gourmet, all of which is certainly possible in a generic Northeastern setting.
Have you ever done anything else unusual to get a role, ask for parts that were, you know,
asked for parts that weren't specified black and there were therefore assumed to be white.
Well, I've spent actually most of my career doing exactly that.
Uh-huh.
The lawyer, again, another lawyer that I played in Good Mother, the Diane Keaton film.
Mm-hmm.
I was the only black man who showed up for that part. And when I showed up, Leonard Nimoy and I had a very long conversation about, as he put it, introducing color into his movie. And I literally presented my case, as it were, as if I had been a lawyer. And it was that particular conversation that convinced him that I should be allowed to read. And finally, we sort of became friends and he gave me the part. I think it's something that actors of color and actually even women, actresses, should spend a lot of time doing. I think that we live in a world, and certainly this business, that's based on image. And when someone writes a script or someone's deciding to direct a script or produce a script, they go at it vis-a-vis their image, who they think these people are, what their life experiences has been. And without any malice or forethought, they eliminate a great section of what might be out there. And unless you bring up the idea, I don't think in many cases they would think of it on their own. So I think it's something that actors should do as often as possible. And the reason I say women is there are lots of parts that are lawyers or doctors or whatever who don't have, let's say, a love relationship or, you know, whatever in the script that would nullify that kind of idea. And they can go in and say, you know, I read this part here and there's no reason, for instance, this part could not be played by a woman, or there's no reason this part could not be played by a black or Chicano or an Asian. And you could even stretch it so far as to say that by someone who is of quote-unquote advanced years. I mean, I think it's something that once you bring up the idea, you might, in fact, get the creative wheels to spin.
Are there stock roles for black actors that you became accustomed to seeing over the years?
Yes. I mean, I stayed away from television just because of that, because it seemed to me on TV, black actors played one of two kinds of roles. They either played buffoons or they played really bad individuals who had no sense of conscience whatsoever. And so that seemed to be the only possibilities. And in film, at that time, I started working this business in 1968. There, not until the 70s, and in the 70s there was mostly black exploitation, there just was nothing in between. I didn't see my particular life experience or the life experience of middle-class individuals who happened to be black on the screen. I didn't see stories about just men and women who met, fell in love, and had children or didn't have children and had whatever problems that they had to work out. All I saw was that black represented either someone who had to fight for proving his equality in the world or was incarcerated, mm-hmm. or was just so silly that he couldn't be taken seriously.
Did you ever audition for any of the blaxploitation films?
Absolutely not.
You didn't want to be part of it?
No.
Actor Joe Morton is my guest. He stars on the television series Equal Justice. He's also appeared in the films Brother from Another Planet, Tap, and Trouble in Mind. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Joe Morton is my guest. Let me ask you about some of your experiences coming of age. I know you spent your early childhood on army bases in right. Europe. What did your father do?
My father was a captain in the army, and his duty, in fact, was to integrate the armed forces overseas. So that meant we were usually one of two black families on an army post, which in the mid to late 1950s was probably not the most enjoyable circumstances. But at the same time, certainly a great education for both my mother and I.
What kind of education are you talking
about?
Well,
in terms of, I guess, the depth and idiosyncrasies of racism. I mean, I remember a story where I was a kid and I was selling, I don't know if you remember, I don't know how old you are, but there used to be comic books, and at the back of the comic books, you know, you could sell Christmas cards, and then depending on how many number of Christmas cards you sold, you would get a bicycle or whatever it might be. And I used to sell them on the post. And I went to one door, and I knocked on the door, and I was no more than maybe 8. And a young kid came to the door, younger than I was, and said, "Mommy, there's a nigger at the door." And my first response was absolute rage and anger. And my second response was actually that this kid was too young to know what he was talking about. He was simply repeating something that he had heard his parents say. So it was things like that that sort of begin to crystallize in terms of what racism is about. The other side of the coin, of course, is I was in battles with kids on the other side of the neighborhood. That is, the only other black kid and I were in battles with them most all the time. And because of my father's training in the Army, we actually were taught how to hide weapons and move them all around the post so in case we were in trouble, we could go and protect ourselves.
So you were taught as a child how to hide weapons?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, weapons meaning sticks and garbage can lids and slingshots and broom handles. No, not guns and knives. No, no, no. This was just to keep people away from you, not to kill anybody or hurt anybody unless they were trying to do the same to you.
How often did you have to use it?
Several times. I mean, at least three or four times a week. I mean, you know, that's the situation you find yourself in. You are living in a very explosive set of circumstances on an Army post. Everybody on that post has a weapon in their home. Everybody came to that post knowing what was going on in terms of, found out what was going on in terms of integration. Everybody had real hard feelings about it one way or the other, pro and con. And the children, all of them, found themselves in the middle. Either they were repulsed by it, or they found themselves doing exactly the same thing that their parents might do if they were against the black people, or us black people, being there. The reverse, of course, was just as true. My father died when I was 10, and we came back to the United States, and I literally went from Dachau to Sugar Hill, which is 155th Street and Edgecombe Avenue. And because at the time I could speak fluent Japanese and some German, and because I had no particular regional accent from the South, and because I didn't know how to play basketball, and because I was fairly good in school, I became, as did the brother from another planet, the stranger. And I found myself just as frequently in fights with black kids in that particular neighborhood because I was still sort of the outsider. So racism really comes down to sort of cultural patterns. What I mean by that is if you enter any particular group as the stranger, more than likely you'll be ostracized whether you are the same skin color or not. If you are outside the norm, most people's response is fear and aggression.
I just want to get back to something you said a moment ago. You said you literally went from Dachau to Sugar Hill.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean? Were you stationed right near Dachau?
We were stationed in Dachau, yeah. That was the last place we were stationed before we came back to the States.
In the concentration camp?
Yeah, it had been converted into an army base. And so the dependent buildings were on one side of the fence, and the barracks were on the other side of the fence. And actually, at times when I was a kid, you could, because there is that sort of museum that was left there. You could actually walk into the museum and watch the tours and walk into the showers and open up the doors to the ovens and so forth. And for a kid who was at that time 9 or 10, it was sort of like a house of horrors, as opposed to what you begin to realize as you get older and you understand the depths of what happened there. So yes, we were actually stationed in Dachau. We weren't just sort of near it.
When you moved back to the States, did the knowledge you had about how to hide things you could use as weapons come in handy? Did you
ever No, because that? The shock of being now in fights with people who were my own race was so overwhelming that it just stayed just that shock. I just couldn't somehow understand or get over the fact that I was now in battles with other black kids because I was different. And so what I ended up doing was my mother realized how difficult my first year was when we came back to the States. And so she found this military school in Newburgh, New York, and asked me, did I want to go? And I gave a rousing yes, because it was at least something that I understood on some level. And so I went to military school for 3 years, a Catholic military school, which is sounds like it's redundant, but it's not. And actually it was... It was probably the best thing that happened to me. It sort of was a place where I found a great deal of focus. I learned how to be very disciplined and actually began to realize that I had some verbal skills and began to use them. It was also a place to for me to overcompensate like mad, which is what I did. By the time I graduated from that school, I think I was second or third in my class and major of the school, which is the top-ranking officer of the school, and drum major of the band. So I had a great deal of control, which is what I think I thought I needed at the time.
What got you interested in acting?
Actually, I'd been writing music while I was in high school, and when I entered college as a psychology major, and they sort of trotted us around the university to show us, you know, what the university looked like, and then they took us into the theater to show us skits of what our first year at Hofstra University might be like. And at the end of these skits, everyone left the theater, and I just sat there thinking, you know, I like to sing and I like to write music. Maybe I could be an actor. And I left the theater and walked to the registrar's office and changed all my majors from psychology to drama. And that was it.
Your first breaks were in musicals, but you moved away from musicals.
Well, it was something I never wanted to do. I mean, I'd spent 3 years training as a classical actor, wanting to do Shakespeare and the Greeks and wanting all of that to parlay itself into dramatic roles in film. But when I came into the city in 1968, there were no such roles for black actors, and the only things that were available were things like Jimmy Shine and Big Dime Buck White or musicals. And as it turned out, I auditioned for all of them and ended up in Hair. So that sort of sent me rolling for a while. I did musicals for as long as I thought it did me some good. But to me, it seemed like it was a dead end, unless you wanted to be a song and dance man and use that as sort of the core of who you are as an entertainer. It wouldn't take me very far, and it certainly wouldn't take me to film as someone respected as a dramatic actor. So I left doing musicals and started doing regional theater, started getting back to the things I wanted to do in the first place. My idea was that your first step in any business is to get well-known within the community, within the industry itself, and then that sort of brings you to the fore or brings you up to the surface so that the rest of the world can sort of get a glimpse of what you do, and that seemed to work very well. And then after I did that for a while, I began getting auditions in film, and so I was doing small films, and I guess the first big break was Brother from Another Planet.
Did you have any performance fantasies when you were growing up?
Yeah, whenever we came into New York, however briefly, my grandmother always used to take me to the Apollo, and very often it was to see Sammy Davis Jr., in fact, and one of my fantasies was that, you know, he would look out to the audience and say, ladies and gentlemen, there is a young man out here, and that if we give him some applause, he might grace us with a song. And, of course, that was me, and I would always, in my fantasy, go on stage and sing and dance with Sammy Davis Jr. The closest I got to that fantasy, of course, was Tap. I didn't get to sing and dance with him, but at least we were in the same movie together, so it was sort of a dream come true.
That's right. Well, Joe Morton, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Joe Morton stars in the ABC series Equal Justice. This is Fresh Air. The hosts of All Things Considered are very busy and can't check in with us today, but I have a rundown of some of the stories they're following. From Romania, reporter Kate Hunt on the latest anti-government demonstrations in Bucharest. There are reports that government troops have fired on the demonstrators, killing some of them. Also, the latest on the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. The Coast Guard now says more than 3 million gallons have leaked from the Norwegian tanker Megaborg. And on Capitol Hill today, Minnesota Senator David Duenberger addressed the Senate Ethics Committee, which is investigating his alleged financial misconduct. Moore Eliason will have that report. These stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Owen Gleiberman says the movie Let It Ride, which came out last year, was a victim of poor distribution. It got yanked from theaters almost as soon as it was released. But now the film, starring Richard Dreyfuss, is out on home video, and Owen says it finally has a chance to find the audience it deserves.
Richard Dreyfuss is hardly the first actor to heat up the screen with his fast-talking patter. Yet I can't think of another performer who combines energy and emotion the way Dreyfuss does. His verbal spritzing is the sound of a man trying to convince himself he believes in something. In Let It Ride, Dreyfuss plays yet another cockeyed true believer, like his stargazing everyman in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Only here, he's into a different sort of faith. I'm talking about the feverish, cathartic religion of horse racing. Let It Ride is a wonderfully sly comedy about the people who spend their lives at the track, coasting on $10 bets, booze, and pipe dreams of picking a long shot. Dreyfuss plays Trotter, a scrappy fellow whose compulsive gambling is starting to tear his life apart. Trotter likes to think he's too good for the losers who play the horses all day. But every time he glances around the racetrack saloon, he knows he's one of them. All this changes when his cab driver pal, played by pop star David Johansen, overhears talk of a crooked deal to fix a race. Suddenly, fate has handed Trotter a sure thing.
You really think charity can win?
Do I really think charity can win?
Yeah.
Well, I am walking around in yesterday's suit.
Yeah.
And I do recall just recently telling my wife that I was going to stop gambling and that I was going to move back home right after work this morning.
Yeah.
If I listen closely, I can hear my wife telling our attorney, go for his balls. And you're really asking me whether I think charity can win?
Yeah.
Yes! I think charity can win!
Trotter bets his money and wins. Then he bets all his winnings and wins again. He's having what he would call a very good day. The sweetest victory comes when he ditches the saloon for a seat at the Jockey Club, the upscale bar for wealthy gamblers. For Trotter, it's like entering heaven. It's the hangout for winners. Yet what does it mean to be a winner? The terrific thing about Let It Ride is that it captures the intricate psychology of horse racing. At first, Trotter's pals can't accept having a winner in their midst. Most of them are so accustomed to losing, that's all they really believe in. Trotter has to break free of their gloomy jinx. It's not enough for him to win one race, or two, or even three. To be a true winner, he's got to keep proving his good fortune was no accident. He's got to show his pals that he's of a different breed. Let It Ride is finally a little too much of a fairy tale, but it's still the savviest and most enjoyable American movie about the lure of gambling since Robert Altman's California Split. Dreyfuss, who's occasionally too coy, plugs us right into Trotter's desperation and go-for-broke daring. It's a funny and touching performance, the kind that makes the triumph of a little guy seem richly deserved. And the movie has as many great supporting crazies as a Preston Sturges comedy. Among the standouts are David Johansen as Trotter's hangdog pal, Michelle Phillips as a filthy rich gambler who gets lusty around winners, and Robbie Coltrane as a ticket seller who looks on with both contempt and awe as Trotter places his insanely chancy bets. Let It Ride portrays the people at the track as one big, contentious family. They may not like each other much, but they've all come together to worship at the church of winning.
Owen Gleiberman is a film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy produced the Interview Zone Fresh Air with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by grants from the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Stan Getz talks about his life in jazz. And William Gottlieb tells us about the photos of jazz musicians he took in the 1930s and 40s, pictures you've probably seen on record jackets and book covers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.